It's definitely a matter of debate, and I think it's the same issue that we run into with migraine headache, which is sometimes the things that people might perceive as triggers can sometimes be what's called premonitory phase symptoms, meaning that the brain and the body have already entered the beginning of an attack, and you might start to feel things like irritability or fatigue, and you might think, oh, I'm tired, maybe I slept poorly, and that's a trigger, but it can be really hard to tease those two things out. From my perspective, it seems to me that a lot of people, at least kids with cyclic vomiting syndrome, there's almost not necessarily a lifestyle component so much as they're just due for it. It has that periodicity, the passage of time. It's you get it every 6 weeks, and I look at the calendar, and it's been 6 weeks, and so then they have another attack.
For years, migraine has been synonymous with headache, while thousands of people, and maybe you, struggle with bigger gut problems. Cyclic vomiting syndrome, or CVS, is a migraine variant and can be treated with migraine medications. However, the specialists treating it are often gastroenterologists. People with CVS are desperate for help, which can start in childhood and can continue through adulthood. To help us better understand CVS is Dr. Amy Gelfand. She is a neurologist and the director of pediatric headache at UCSF. Dr. Gelfand is regarded by her peers as a world leader in pediatric migraine. She has co-authored a paper on cyclic vomiting syndrome and is here to enlighten us on what it is and ways to manage it. Dr. Gelfand, welcome back to the Migraine World Summit.
Thank you for having me.
Our community submits topics for the Migraine World Summit, and CVS received so many votes from people that are just desperate for help. As Kathy wrote, every CVS patient has horror stories to tell. I, in particular, was surprised to see how often it affects adults as well as children. When is it most commonly diagnosed?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that it's only relatively recently been appreciated that CVS also occurs in adults. Beforehand, it was really thought of as a childhood disorder. And I think that's part of why what was called in our earlier headache classification system childhood periodic syndromes got changed to episodic syndromes that may be associated with migraine, really to recognize that CVS and other syndromes like abdominal migraine can also affect adults. In terms of whether it's more likely to affect adults or children, I think we still don't really know, because even basic things like what's the prevalence of this in the population is not exactly known. I think it might, to a certain extent, depend on your clinical context, and certainly as a pediatric headache specialist, I'm seeing more children, but I do see adults with CVS as well, and there are more adults, so it may simply be that there are more adults with CVS just on a population basis, but these are basic questions that from a research standpoint we really need to answer.
And diagnosis of CVS can be very difficult.
Yes.
Why is that?
I think a number of reasons. CVS can be a little bit tricky to untangle, whether is it some sort of gastrointestinal problem that's going on? Is it an inborn error of metabolism that looks like cyclic vomiting syndrome? Some sort of problem with how the body makes or uses energy sometimes can cause recurrent attacks of vomiting, but they don't necessarily have that periodicity that you see with cyclic vomiting syndrome. But there's so many things that can look sort of like cyclic vomiting syndrome, that it can be really confusing, and it can take some time to sort through the differential to figure out what's going on here and to come to a diagnosis of cyclic vomiting syndrome.
So what other symptoms should parents and individuals take note of beyond vomiting?
For cyclic vomiting syndrome or for some of the other things that might be going on?
For CVS.
Okay. So with CVS, other than vomiting, obviously nausea would be a common symptom. And then abdominal pain is commonly seen as well. Sometimes the kids, when they're having it, may be very fatigued, irritable, fussy, not quite themselves. Those would be the kind of symptoms that we'd see with it.
What about headache? Do you see headache with it as well?
So if you take a careful history, you may find that the patient also has headache during the attacks. It becomes a little bit of a semantic issue, because at least the way that I approach it as a headache neurologist, because our classification system works the way that it does, if that headache fits the criteria of migraine in terms of being pounding and unilateral and with light and sound sensitivity, we would actually then say that the disorder we're treating is migraine. But that doesn't really capture this in a satisfying way for people, because when you have also that periodicity and all the vomiting, it doesn't quite seem like episodic migraine either. So sometimes I think of that situation as periodic migraine with quite a bit of vomiting, also known as cyclic vomiting syndrome, just to finesse the semantics a bit.
I can see why it could be difficult to diagnose.
Yeah, it's a little tricky.
What is the difference between abdominal migraine and CVS?
So there's certainly overlap in the symptoms. I think of two things when I try to differentiate those two. The first is there a periodicity, meaning some sort of predictable interval that the attacks are coming at for that given individual, whether it's every 6 weeks, every 8 weeks. Cyclic vomiting syndrome is cyclic. It's periodic. People usually can tell you how often they get attacks. Abdominal migraine, a little bit more like migraine, might come at a bit more of a random frequency. The other thing that I find helpful in differentiating is just which symptom is really the dominant one that we're hearing about. With CVS, it's vomiting. It's just vomiting, vomiting, vomiting is awful. And abdominal migraine, there may be some vomiting, but the predominant symptom that the person's coming in because of is abdominal pain, usually.
Okay. Why does migraine affect the stomach at all?
I think it's still unclear whether it's affecting the gastrointestinal tract, because there certainly are a lot of neurons in the gastrointestinal tract, and so we might be seeing some of the same phenomena, or if it's just where the person is perceiving the pain and the distress may be. Maybe in younger people or in people who have CVS, it's being perceived more as coming from the GI tract or the abdominal region, but the process is still brain-driven and brain-mediated. And so it's a little bit tricky to know whether there's something actually happening within the stomach itself or if it's up higher.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. I hadn't heard the explanation before. What are some common triggers that might set off a CVS attack?
It's definitely a matter of debate, and I think it's the same issue that we run into with migraine headache, which is sometimes the things that people might perceive as triggers can sometimes be what's called premonitory phase symptoms, meaning that the brain and the body have already entered the beginning of an attack, and you might start to feel things like irritability or fatigue, and you might think, oh, I'm tired, maybe I slept poorly, and that's a trigger. But it can be really hard to tease those two things out. From my perspective, it seems to me that a lot of people, at least kids with cyclic vomiting syndrome, there's almost not necessarily a lifestyle component so much as they're just due for it. It has that periodicity, the passage of time. You get it every 6 weeks, and I look at the calendar, and it's been 6 weeks, and so then they have another attack.
Okay. So you may have answered this question already, but should CVS then be viewed as a gastrointestinal issue or a neurological one, and then who then should see the patient?
It's like asking the hammer what's a nail. But, as a neurologist, I really think that cyclic vomiting syndrome is a neurologic disease, and I think it's a brain-mediated disease, and so I think that a neurologist should be involved. That said, with the differential diagnosis being so complex, it can be really helpful to also have the patient see a gastroenterologist in order to make sure that there's not something else that's being missed. Usually when I see a patient who I think they have cyclic vomiting syndrome, I do like them to at least have a one-time visit with a gastroenterologist just to make sure that there's nothing else that we should be thinking about. Not to give kids more doctor's appointments, but I think just the reassurance that we've covered our bases can be really helpful for both the family and for me as a provider.
Right, I would definitely see it from that perspective too, to have that peace of mind. In a paper that you published in 2017, you indicate that CVS often predates the onset of migraine. Have you found ways to prevent the progression through early intervention?
I wish that I could answer yes. Mm-hmm. At this point, I would say I don't think so. I still think that that remains a possibility and that is something we should be striving to do. Preventing migraine from developing is a critical goal. But at this point, I'm not sure that we've figured out yet how to do that.
Right. How often does CVS evolve into more typical migraine over time?
Probably about half the time, maybe even a little bit more than that. It probably depends a bit on how long you follow the person for. The child might outgrow CVS and might have a little bit of a pause, and then for a few years, and then start to have migraine. So it depends a little bit over what period of time you're following them, but I would say something on the order of about 50% to maybe 2/3.
Okay, that's pretty high.
It's pretty high.
And when you do go on to have more typical migraine, do you often then have vomiting as a part of your attack?
That's an interesting question. I haven't seen that specifically looked at in the literature. From a clinical impression, I would say I think so. It does seem like that does seem to be more prominent, but I don't think we really know.
Right. Okay, something to think about.
Yeah, exactly.
Good to you.
Yeah, I like it.
So we'll talk about treatments now if we can. I'd like to know what treatments are available for CVS and if they might differ for adults versus children.
Sure. So a CVS treatment breaks down the same way that it does for migraine. You have preventive treatment that's aimed at decreasing attack frequency, and then you have acute treatment that's aimed at treating the attack in the moment. These, from my perspective and I think from the literature as well, are essentially the same in terms of what we would offer for an adult or for a child. For prevention, there could be certain supplements that are helpful for some people. These are supplements that help the mitochondria, the energy powerhouses of your cells. So coenzyme Q10 would be an example of that. L-carnitine would be another one, or riboflavin. On the pharmacology side, the tricyclic antidepressants like amitriptyline would be commonly used for trying to decrease frequency. Acute treatments, there are certainly choices there. There are anti-nausea medications, and there's different classes, and they act on different receptors, but we might think about ones like ondansetron, which acts on serotonin receptors, prochlorperazine, which acts on dopamine receptors, and a relatively novel class, the class that acts on what's called neurokinin 1 receptors. They were originally developed for treating chemotherapy-related nausea and vomiting, but that's a medication like a aprepitant can be helpful for acute treatment. And because it lasts for a long time in its clinical effect, can maybe even be helpful for prevention as well.
Interesting. Now, with these medications and supplements that you've mentioned, are those all appropriate for adults and children, did you say?
Or? Yes. Okay. Yeah, those would all be used for adults and children. Certainly in the treatment of migraine, we have a lot of experience using amitriptyline in children and similarly for cyclic vomiting syndrome, and also for those acute medications like ondansetron and the other ones I was using that I was mentioning. They've all certainly been used extensively in children for a number of diagnoses, so we know how to dose them, we know how to give them safely, and those types of things.
How difficult is it to stop an attack? And you mentioned some different acute treatments, but are they orally based, or what do you do? How do you stop
Right. them? So, or it can be really tricky because there's so much vomiting. It can be hard to hold down an oral medication. And if somebody were to take something orally and then vomit shortly thereafter, how much was absorbed? Can you redose it? There's all these kind of questions. That said, oral formulations of medicines are still often the easiest for people to just have on hand in their house, or if they're traveling, to bring with them because they're small and they travel well. So a lot of times oral medications are used in acute treatment of cyclic vomiting syndrome. But sometimes that's just not going to work because somebody's vomiting way too much. And so in that type of situation, you want to think about other routes that you can give the medication through. So nasal sprays could be an option where you can get absorption across the mucosa of the nasal lining. Sometimes suppositories in the rectum. No one's favorite route, but sometimes necessary. And then if you are really having a difficult time, possibly through injection at home or intravenous treatment in something like an urgent care or an emergency department setting.
I'm assuming, like with a typical migraine attack, the earlier you treat it, the better or the faster, and the more likely it is to be effective. So
yeah.
How do you know when to treat a CVS attack? How do you know what differentiates it from just having a stomach ache or mm-hmm. something else like that going on?
I would say that I take care of a number of kids with cyclic vomiting syndrome where it comes on while they're asleep and they wake up with it, and it's just really clear right away that that's what they're dealing with. And so I think in that situation, trying to treat as aggressively as possible, as soon as possible, makes perfect sense. I think that, you know, with a routine stomach ache coming from something else, like a tummy bug, you might feel more of the pain for a while and it might go a little more slowly. But with a cyclic vomiting syndrome attack, usually the vomiting comes on fast and it comes on really prominently. And if that's what's happening, I think you go for your treatment as soon as you possibly can.
And like you said, too, with the cycles, you know, it seems like you can start to
follow. If you know you're due for it,
right.
Then that would also help with thinking, okay, this must be what's going on.
Are there any risks or side effects with some of these treatments that you've mentioned that parents or individuals should be aware of, particularly if perhaps our family doctor isn't as familiar with CVS?
Right. So we covered a lot of territory. So backing up to those preventive treatments, with the mitochondrial supplements, the coenzyme Q10 and the L-carnitine and the riboflavin, fortunately, generally speaking, those are very well tolerated and not a lot in the way of side effects. The L-carnitine can have kind of a fishy taste, so when you burp, it might be a little unpleasant, but generally speaking, nothing dangerous to be worried about there. With the pharmacologic treatments, things like amitriptyline, again, have been around for a long time, so a lot of family practice doctors will be very familiar with that class of medicines. But in terms of possible side effects, you can get dry mouth, constipation. I do usually like to check the heart rhythm to make sure that there's not a lengthening of a part of the heart rhythm called the QT interval. Those are some possible side effects that can come with those kind of medicines. With the as-needed ones, things such as ondansetron, sometimes headache can come as a side effect. And with aprepitant, this more novel class that we were talking about, it's usually really well tolerated. People can sometimes get hiccups, and I'd say that the bigger risk might be more to the pocketbook, because sometimes it can be hard to get insurance to cover some of these more novel treatments, and they can be a little more on the costly side.
As we're talking about treatments, it does make me wonder, what's the youngest age at which you might see a patient with this, and how might it be different, or where have you seen connections with infants with colic, perhaps?
So in our practice, I think that probably the youngest we've seen come through with cyclic vomiting syndrome is 2. A little more typical would be around age 5, 6, or 7 in terms of when it starts. But it is possible, like we were talking about, to have CVS start in adulthood, and usually in someone's 20s, mid-20s. We're still learning a lot about the relationship between the different episodic syndromes, but at least on an anecdotal level, I will say it's definitely possible to go from one, like infantile colic, to another, like cyclic vomiting syndrome, as the person goes over the course of development and then ultimately into migraine itself. So that seems to be like there can be a developmental effect of the brain going through those different sort of stages or expressions of migraine, if you will.
If you're in a particularly bad episode of CVS, of a CVS attack, how can you prevent a trip to the ER?
Right. So I think trying to have as many tools in your toolkit as possible, having your first line treatments that you go to, but then having at least one rescue option, something that you can take if that first line doesn't get the job done. And maybe the first line treatment is an oral one, but your rescue uses another route so that we can ideally get something in to help stop the attack, even if the vomiting is so profound that you can't hold down something orally. Sometimes, though, unfortunately, with CVS, sometimes the vomiting is just so prolific that dehydration starts to become an issue. And in that kind of a situation, going to the emergency room really does become necessary.
One of our viewers, Bob, does not get head pain, but has CVS attacks 4 to 5 times a week. He had to discontinue nausea meds, but has found some relief with cannabis oil. Is that a treatment to potentially add to your toolbox?
Not that I've seen from any sort of studies. I think if it's something that you were thinking about using topically, I'm thinking with an oil that might be a topical use. I don't think that would be unsafe. And so if it makes someone feel more comfortable, I think that would be reasonable. I worry a little bit about any kind of systemic cannabis, whether it's CBD or cannabis itself. The reason that I worry about that in somebody who has cyclic vomiting syndrome is that there's this thing called cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, which can have very similar symptoms to cyclic vomiting syndrome, episodes of very profound vomiting. And it seems like that comes out more in people who have been exposed to cannabis frequently over time. So I worry a little bit, even though it might be really natural to think about, oh, cannabis can help with nausea, I worry that if you already have cyclic vomiting syndrome, maybe there's even a greater susceptibility that if you then add in cannabis exposure, that you could also get this cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome. So generally speaking, I favor avoiding cannabis in someone who has cyclic vomiting syndrome, but I think if it's something like a topical, I don't think that would be a problem.
Right. You know, one of our viewers actually wrote in saying that she was having that discussion with her doctor about which it could be. You know, the doctor wasn't convinced that it was CVS because of that. So
yeah, it can be really tricky to tease that apart.
Well, what other suggestions do you give to people about how they can really improve their quality of life while dealing with CVS?
Yeah, I think the first thing is to try to find a provider who is knowledgeable about CVS and who has an interest in CVS, ideally a provider team where there are different people who can work together so that you have a team who you can turn to for advice and for support. I think that's something that's missing for far too many patients. And then I also think about making sure you have all your tools in your toolkit that you have with you, all of your rescue medicines, all of your acute medicines, making sure you have them available if you're going in the car, if you're going on a trip, if you're going to school, that they go where you go so that you can use them as quickly as possible if needed, and keeping them up to date. And then because going to the emergency department sometimes does become a necessity for people who have CVS, having some kind of written documentation from your provider that explains what is this diagnosis, what is the recommended treatment plan in the emergency department, that can hopefully help bridge the gap in maybe provider knowledge and hopefully introduce the condition if the person taking care of you doesn't know about it and maybe give a little bit of ideas and guidance about how to manage this attack.
So you're not seen as a drug seeker, perhaps, or...
Yes, exactly. You know, avoiding being stigmatized or really seen in an unfair light, I think, is something we need to make sure happens for patients.
A lot of our viewers have problems with nausea, and that can, in fact, be their most disabling symptom that they deal with. Can you talk about that a little bit and why that happens?
I'm so glad to actually talk about this topic because I completely agree that nausea can be even more disabling than the other symptoms of migraine, head pain, vertigo, whatever it is. Nausea can be really, really awful. And I would say that it's one of the symptoms that we get the most calls about from families we're taking care of. And it can be so, so hard. So in terms of strategies to try to help with nausea, starting maybe first with thinking about some pharmacology and then working out to some non-pharmacologic things. We do have different classes of medications that can help with nausea. There's the class that's called serotonin receptor antagonists, and that's medications like ondansetron or granisetron. These are oral medications that come in pill form or dissolving tablet form. Then there are medications that act on dopamine receptors. These would be things like prochlorperazine or chlorpromazine, again, available as oral tablets or in some instances as a suppository, or if you're in an emergency room type setting, you could get those as an intravenous treatment. And then the more recent class of medications that act as antagonists at this receptor called the neurokinin 1 receptor, those are things like aprepitant, or there's a IV formulation that's the prodrug, meaning before it gets cut, that's fosaprepitant. So those are some different classes of medications that can sometimes be helpful for nausea. And then I would say that, you know, triptan medicines or medicines that are treating migraine acutely, they ideally are also addressing the associated symptoms in addition to the pain. And so it's not unreasonable to think about using your acute headache medicine, whether it's an NSAID or a triptan, also to hopefully help with some of these other associated symptoms too. So those are some of the pharmacologic strategies that I would think of right off the bat. And then thinking now more towards non-pharmacologic things, some of our patients find it helpful to use acupuncture or acupressure. There are also some bands, either like C bands, which are a little simpler, or devices that are essentially TENS units, like nerve stimulator units, where they're a little more expensive to get that, but it's something where you can wear it on your wrist. You set it to whatever setting you feel is most sensitive, but not uncomfortable, and sometimes that can be helpful. Because one of the issues with really frequent nausea is you can't keep using all of your acute nausea medicines. You're either running out, or they're not covered by insurance, or there's some dosing or medical medication interaction issue. And so for people who have really frequent, really difficult nausea, even with all of those medication choices, you still sometimes need non-pharmacologic things. And people might prefer non-pharmacologic options, particularly for children and teenagers, where with young people, we try to minimize how many medications are going into their body. So those can be some strategies. Aromatherapy is another thing that can be helpful. Whether it's there's a little bit of data for lavender oil and migraine, peppermint oil. There's an interesting study that has nothing to do with migraine, and it might sound kind of crazy, but it's a study that was done in the emergency department setting in adults coming in with nausea and comparing medications like ondansetron with smelling those alcohol swabs, like the little disposable ones that you open and can smell. And for some reason, which I still don't really understand, breathing in the alcohol swab smell was actually quite helpful for people's nausea. You can buy those over the counter. I always feel kind of silly when I'm telling families to sniff alcohol swabs, but it has evidence behind it, and it could be a non-pharmacologic strategy. And then sometimes people will find it helpful to use like ginger chews or ginger drops, like little. There's lots of different formulations for this, little candies or chews or ginger ale, things that can maybe help with settling the stomach. With nausea, it can be really hard to eat and drink adequately. So I usually recommend trying to take frequent small sips, because we want you to try to stay hydrated, and you don't want to try to stretch out your belly too fast, because that can sometimes make nausea a little worse. But just trying to, you know, every 5 or 10 minutes, just take a sip or two of whatever beverage to try and get good fluids in. And then thinking similarly with trying to eat, not trying to take in a big meal all at once, but maybe doing a little bit more of grazing, a bite here, a bite there, as you can tolerate it, and thinking a little bit more about blander foods, things on the more gentle end of the spectrum. If you think about when you were a kid and maybe you had a tummy virus and you had some vomiting and diarrhea, like, what did your parents give you? It's probably like toast or bananas or something that's a little bit more plain, one color, very gentle, not spicy. Those sort of measures can maybe help with trying to stay well hydrated, trying to keep your energy up while you're going through a bad stretch of nausea.
Right. I often crave carbs when I'm nauseous with a migraine attack. And for a long time, I would kind of feed that, you know, and go after that. But I've actually found that protein makes me feel a lot better in the long run and kind of helps to get that under control. You know, are there certain foods that really kind of work better to start to shut that nausea down? Or?
That's really interesting. I think that it seems to be so individual for different people. And so I think that's a great example of how you were able to observe something that you were experiencing and find the best ways to manage it for you. And I think a certain amount of trial and error probably does pay off a bit for trying to figure out if whether it's something that I think of more as a simple carb like toast versus I don't know, what do you find is most like cheese or what sort of protein?
Yeah, I went
do
like
you
a chicken sandwich.
Oh wow, okay.
Maybe I'm getting it all.
So. Wow, yeah, whether it's like some sort of chicken breast or like hard boiled egg or something like that. I think it's gonna depend a little bit on the person, mm-hmm. and it's another good example of how complex and heterogeneous migraine is, that you know, certain things will set people off, whereas others won't. You know, I think about caffeine, and some people will find caffeine actually helps stop an attack, and other people feel like it provokes an attack. And so some of these different things can be really individualized in their effects.
Yes, absolutely. And can we talk a little bit about migraine medications that would be your first go-tos if someone was feeling nauseous, that they could be sick? You know, tell me a little bit about some treatments you would use when you might not want to use oral tablets.
Absolutely. So when I'm seeing a patient who has a lot of nausea and or vomiting as part of their migraine attacks, we always talk about different strategies for how to get medication in because it may be really difficult. And sometimes we can still use an oral route with a dissolving tablet that might be absorbed a little bit more quickly, but sometimes that's just out. And so in that situation, the first thing I would think about would be a nasal spray formulation. So this is something where you spray it up in one side or sometimes both, depending on the dose of the nose, and just just let it rest there, and it gets absorbed across the lining of the mucosa of the nose, and you have a lot of blood vessels there, and so it can actually be absorbed very rapidly, a lot faster even than it would be if you were taking it by mouth. And it can also, that can also be helpful for people who have attacks that come on really, really quickly. Something that, that can get a good blood level quickly, that can be a good route for that situation as well. Sometimes people just really feel uncomfortable spraying something in their nose, or it doesn't work for them, or they just don't like the taste of it if they get a little bit of it coming at the back of their throat. So in that situation, we could also think about injectables. Needles are not necessarily fun, especially for kids, but if it's a question of an injection versus ending up in the emergency department for 6 hours while you're feeling absolutely terrible, you know, going with a injectable may be helpful. So sumatriptan can come as an injectable formulation and gets absorbed very, very rapidly that way. A little trickier, but you can actually get it compounded as a suppository as well, so per rectum. And some of the anti-nausea medicines can be given per rectum as well. And then certain NSAID medicines can be given as injections too. I'm thinking of Ketorolac, which can come as home injections. And I had mentioned that when we were talking about nasal sprays, that some of the triptans are available that way. There's also a formulation of dihydrogotamine, DHE, that's available as nasal spray or by injection. So those would be some of the different ways that we could give a medication, essentially bypassing the GI tract and getting more direct absorption. And then, of course, if you do find yourself in the unfortunate situation of landing in an emergency department, there's quite a few intravenous options as well.
Right. Now, I got a recommendation recently from a headache specialist that I could add an anti-nausea medicine to kind of my acute toolbox, yeah, even if I weren't nauseous. Mm. So, you know, could you talk a little bit about why that might be effective?
Yeah, I think it might depend on which class you're thinking of there. So when I think about the ones like on Dansetron, I do think of that more as treating nausea. But if we think about some of the older classes, the phenothiazines like prochlorperazine or chlorpromazine, those are really anti-migraine agents. In addition to having an anti-nausea effect, they've been studied for migraine and for pain. And so some people actually use those as their acute treatment. If for some reason they can't take triptans or they can't use NSAIDs or those things don't work for them, they might use them as their acute migraine treatment. And they, in addition to treating nausea, can also be helpful with migraine pain. There's actually a nice study in children in the emergency room setting where they were randomly assigned to either an NSAID medicine, Ketorolac, or one of these dopamine-acting agents, prochlorperazine, and the prochlorperazine arm did better. The kids who were in that group were more likely to be headache improved after a certain period of time than the ones who got that NSAID medicine. And so some of those have more than one purpose where they really can help with not just the nausea but also the pain itself.
That's interesting. It was also recommended to me to use it as a rescue strategy too, mm-hmm, if my, you know, my regular acute treatment wasn't effective.
Yeah, I would say that one of the things that's a little bit trickier sometimes with some of those medicines is that they can be a little bit sedating sometimes, and sometimes people will need to go to sleep after taking them. And so as a first line acute, that can be a downside, because ideally what we have for our patient is, you know, migraine starts and they take their acute medicines and they work and they can go back to their day and continue to function. That's our best case scenario and what we're striving for. But if that doesn't work, or if for some reason that can't be taken, a rescue medicine, even if it is one that makes you a little bit tired, maybe at that point resting and sleep can sometimes be helpful for stopping migraine too. Maybe that would be an okay second line option and preferable to landing in an emergency room.
I do find that if I'm at the rescue medicine point in my migraine journey, that sleep is often the only thing, yeah, really that will finally kind of help me get rid of it. What about with CVS too? Is sleep, does it have the same kind of benefit there?
I would say so. CVS is interesting because it really at least in some of the kids that I take care of, it really seems to start while they're in sleep. It seems to have this circadian component or the hypothalamus, which is the area of the brain that regulates our clock, seems to be involved. And so sometimes it can actually start in the middle of the night, and then it can be just very difficult to get back to sleep because of the frequency of the vomiting. But if you can get things to quiet down enough so that you can get some rest, then I think it can help with settling down an attack.
Right. But first you have to get through the worst of it potentially.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yep. And what about the gut-brain connection? I feel like that's all over the news these days. And is there anything you would like to say about that?
I think we are just scratching the surface on our understanding. I mean, certainly I think we appreciate that second only to the brain, there's the greatest amount of neurons in the gut. So there's a lot going on in there. And the gastrointestinal tract produces quite a bit of serotonin. That's a really important chemical in migraine, in mood, in a number of medications that we're using act on serotonin receptors. And so there's a lot of similarities between the different areas. But in terms of whether the microbiome makes a difference for migraine, whether you're more likely to get migraine or more frequent migraine if you have different populations of gut microbes, we are just starting to figure that all out. And I think it'll be really interesting and very exciting to see how it all pans out. But at this point, it's the Wild West.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So more to come.
More to come. Okay. Yes.
My one other question I have for you is, you spoke at the most recent Congress for the International Headache Society about the interplay between genetic and the environmental and pediatric headache. And I was just curious about how this topic relates to what we've been talking about today, to the CVS patient, to other pediatric patients that you see.
Yeah, so I think fundamentally migraine, and I include cyclic vomiting syndrome. I know we call it an episodic syndrome associated with migraine, but I think of it as a form of migraine. Fundamentally, migraine is a genetic disorder. If you carefully take a family history, you're more likely than not to find a family history of migraine. And there seem to be certain genes that are more common in people who have migraine and certain things running within families. So I think fundamentally it's a genetic disorder, but clearly our genes they're not functioning in a vacuum. They're influenced by the environmental exposures that we go through. And some of those are developmental. And so, you know, you're not the same person when you're 5 years old as you were when you were a baby or when you enter puberty. There's all kinds of new exposures that, well, not exactly environmental because they're coming from the body, hormonal fluctuations. There's a lot changing there that can influence migraine. And so, it's a very complex area, another one that we're really trying to untangle. But I think you fundamentally start with a genetic predisposition to migraine, and then certain environmental influences probably impact how easy it is for migraine to activate, how frequently migraine may activate, how hard it might be to shut it off. And I think that much of that will operate whether we're talking about migraine in a more traditional sense or cyclic vomiting syndrome.
Is there a breakdown of how it does kind of break out between the environmental and the genetic, would you say?
I wish I knew. I don't think we know. Yeah, that's a good question.
And with CVS, I know with more typical migraine, you see it often start to spike as kids go through puberty and get to that point in their development. Do you see a similar kind of rise in CVS at that point?
Sometimes I find that there's a little bit of like a transition period where it might have started out as something that really a cyclic vomiting syndrome, and then maybe for a couple of years it's episodes of headache with movement sensitivity and a lot of vomiting, but it still has a lot of periodicity. And so, you know, do you call that migraine? Do you call that cyclic vomiting syndrome? Where exactly it's in this little overlap zone, maybe when people are 8 or 10 years old. And then as they get older, becoming more very clear that, okay, this is migraine. And so it can be interesting to see how the way that migraine is expressing itself can really change as the brain and as the child is developing over those years, and going from something that's one clear-cut thing to this really murky combined type picture to another clear-cut thing.
Right. It makes it all the more confusing to
yes,
figure
it
out.
Yes, it does. You never know when you're meeting a person where they are in that progression.
Right. That's right. Yeah. Exactly. Well, I think that on behalf of all of our viewers that struggle with this, we're so grateful to have someone like you in our corner. So
thank you very much.
You.
Absolutely.
We appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Any final thoughts that you would like to leave with our viewers?
There is a organization, the Cyclic Vomiting Syndrome Association, that is a patient-founded and patient-supporting group, a nonprofit organization that I think can be a source of information and support. So something that somebody could look at online. And then because cyclic vomiting syndrome is thought to be associated with migraine, I would also refer people to the American Headache Society and the American Migraine Foundation websites.
Great. Well, I'm sure a lot of people would love the opportunity to speak with you, and you mentioned supportive doctors and supportive care, mm-hmm. but how could people follow you or learn more about the work that you're doing?
Certainly any publications that we might put out would ultimately make it onto PubMed.gov. And my personal Twitter handle is @AAGelfand, AAGELFAND.
Great. And we'll also put that underneath your interview. We'll make sure we have that information.
Great.
So thank you so much for your time. Thank you for joining us on the Migraine World Summit.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.